This is Pauline Jennings, and you're listening to Musician Talk. This week, I get to talk about my first love of the stage, musical theater, with Eric E. Parrish, who teaches music and theater at Minnesota West Community and Technical College. Eric is currently pursuing his MFA in directing from Minnesota State University in Mankato and holds a Master of Music degree in vocal performance from the University of Northern Colorado and a bachelor's degree in music from Gustavus Adolphus College. A couple of his favorite roles on stage, among many, are Pirate King in Pirates of Penzance, Javert in Les Mis, The Beast in Beauty and the Beast, and his current role as Georges in La Cage aux Folles, performing this month with the Merlin Players at the Paradise for the Performing Arts in Faribault. This Musician Talk episode is different from most in that Eric and I, well, we just talk because, well, there was just so much to talk about. And because musical theater folk rarely have recordings of their work. It's all in the moment, just like the magic of musical theater. Well, it's time to find out about his musical journey. Let's talk with Eric Parrish. Welcome, Eric, to Musician Talk.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you on. Like, this is one of my passions, musical theater. I don't think I've talked to anybody on Musician Talk about that. So I'm really, really happy to have you here today.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, I love it. So we're in for a treat then for both of us.
Exactly.
And the audience.
Exactly. Yay. Let's just start with your musical journey, as we do with everybody. How it started. When did you start singing? When did you start stepping on stage?
I have been singing my whole life. I know it's cliche to say that, but I don't remember a time when I wasn't singing. My dad was the music teacher and the choir director in Medford High School for over 36 years. And my mom was the pianist at our church and forever, like as long as I've been alive. And so I took piano lessons from my mom, and like music was just a part of our household. It's very ironic though, because my mom is very much like a child of the 60s and had, you know, was very into like John Denver and all, and, you know, and all of that kind of like folk movement. Right. Yep. And my dad was born in 1940. And so his music taste was a lot more, you know, a little older, a little more traditional. And so I have this eclectic knowledge of, you know, everything from Mama Cass to Nat King Cole to Bach to church, you know, church music. And
nice.
So I never really understood anything about genre until I started going into school and started, you know, studying more. To me, it was just all music, and it was a way to express yourself, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I played a dress up, my mom's like dress with the, you know, necklace and earrings, and going up, we had a staircase in our house that was right opposite the picture window in our living room. So at nighttime, if you turned all the lights on, you could see yourself in the reflection of the glass of the picture window as you went up and down the stairs. And I was, you know, all the things, Hello Dolly, you know, Marilyn Monroe, everybody doing the shows.
I had one of those too. It was a landing in front of the fireplace that I would get up. I could see myself in the window, but it was where I would perform as a child.
Yes. Yeah. And I used to make my cousins like do all kinds of shows, and I was really, we had a dog, and I was really into the circus at that time. And so, yeah, I made the dog learn how to jump through the hula hoop, and yeah, there was all kinds of, you know, P.T. Barnum. My grandma used to tease me that I was a little P.T. Barnum.
Oh, so that's fun.
My dad also directed all the musicals at the high school in Medford. So I was on stage, you know, helping him paint sets, running backstage. It was just a part of my life, and it was a big deal. And the old Medford High School was a gymatorium. So it was a hole in the wall at the end of the gym.
And terrible acoustics. So, you know, terrible acoustics.
Yeah. Terrible acoustics. You know, very like maybe 12 lights. And he did all the shows with two pianos and a bass player. And I still think today, like even 30 years later, the kind of how can I make this happen with the materials that I have, that attitude that I learned from my dad of, there's no situation that you can't solve. Is you just got to think of it, you just have to be more creative. That time in my life was very influential in my career, and I still hold on to that. And I think a lot of what I do, it comes from that kind of make theater or make art in the space that you have with the materials that you have with the people that you have.
I love this whole idea of you make work what you have. It's such a powerful and great lesson to learn for everything in your life, problem
Yeah,
solving.
it came from this idea of seeing what you have in front of you. I grew up on a farm outside of Medford, and my dad used to we used to go out to the woods, and cut trees and chop firewood and things for our we had a wood burning stove at our house, and he always said it was important for me to observe what I saw in the woods. What does this say, and what does that mean, and how does this look, and how does that interact? And so he was always teaching me about observing. And the last show that he directed, I was in when I was a junior in high school, we did Into the Woods. And so that was kind of like this combination of
Oh,
him and
yeah.
I and our relationship. And that's probably one of my favorite memories from high school
I
theater,
bet.
was doing that show.
Ah.
When I left high school, I wanted to do both music and theater because, again, I was a person that was like, this is all one thing, right? It's not two things.
Sure, right.
Because I had thought about going to the Purbidge School for the Arts. They wanted me to choose a music or theater track, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do both. And then I ended up at Indiana University in Bloomington, in the School of Music, and I thought, I've made it. I've come from this little town, from Medford, of less than 1,000 people, and I've moved to Bloomington, Indiana, to the IU. I've got into like one of the best music schools in the country, and I hated
Oh no. Oh
and
no.
it was awful, and I cried a lot. And
Why was it awful? Why was it awful? What didn't you like?
first off, the dorm was about the size of the town that I grew up in, and I was not prepared for that.
Okay, got it.
And secondly, I was with a lot of musicians who had been formally studying music for a really long time. Not to say that I hadn't been, I took piano lessons, I was taking voice lessons up at St. Olaf as a high school kid, and both of my parents were musicians, so I had a lot of, training. But these kids were like, we're practicing 12 hours a day. They were like diehard kind of scheduled musicians. And I wasn't there because I was technical and I was practicing. I was there because I loved it. And that didn't really fit into the kind of academic situation, right?
I understand. I understand what you're saying.
And not to say that that's bad. And that school is more geared, I think, therefore, to grad students. And because of the kind of the attention of technique, and I wasn't at that point yet. And
Understand.
so, also, it was right at the same time when I was dealing kind of with coming out, and my own sexual and kind of discovering, and it was just a lot. Everything
Yes,
was a
it sounds
lot.
like a lot. Sounds like a
And
lot.
I went home for Christmas, and I was like, please do not make me go back to that place.
Oh.
I hate it. It's so terrible. So I withdrew, and it happened that my dad, because he was involved with ACDA and music, he knew lots of the choir directors in Minnesota and things. And so Dr. Aunia Gustavus, who was the choir director at the time, they had offered me, some scholarship money to go sing. And so we called them up, and they worked their magic. And I was at Gustavus for spring semester of my
Oh,
first
that's
year.
great. That is
Yeah.
great. That's great that you got help instead of roadblocks, which a lot of people, get when they do something like that. So.
Yeah. I mean, and It's definitely, it was about my privilege of,
Yep.
my dad and things like that. And I acknowledge that. But Gustavus was a really great time because it was an opportunity for me to figure out who I was at the pace that I needed it to be, right?
Nice.
And
Yep.
I got to do both music and theater there. They don't have a combined degree, but but I was able to work in both departments and learn a lot from everyone
Oh, that's
there.
great.
I was still in the closet, so it was a little challenging in terms of that. But the connections and the skills that I learned at Gustavus, I'm still like when I'm teaching now, I go, oh, that's what Dr. Jorgensen meant. Oh, that's what Dr. Gardner meant. Like I have these
Nice.
little personal epiphanies. My junior year, my parents were getting divorced, and I was again kind of still coming to terms with my identity. And so the summer between my junior and senior year, I decided that I didn't want to go home.
Okay.
I just needed to get out of Dodge.
Yes,
So
you get
I
that.
ended up Michigan at the Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp as a counselor and a teacher assistant. And I got to meet Mindy Eschter. She's a Twin Cities musician. Her trio was one of the artists in residence there. And while I was working with them, Rob Peebler and Alyssa Dieter was the trio. Alyssa Dieter worked at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And she heard me sing and she's like, have you ever thought about taking your classical voice serious? And I was like, classical? Gross. That's opera singing. Who does that? That's boring.
Right,
I was totally
those operas are
like,
so boring. No,
yeah,
it's
operas are
not.
boring. What are you talking about?
No,
Like,
no.
I here I am with this huge basso profundo voice trying to sing Nat King Cole because that's what, the matchup was. I was obsessed with Sinatra in high school, of course.
Got
And
it.
she's like, no, I think you should take your classical voice. Okay. So I came back to Gustavus my senior year and I went to my voice teacher, Michael Jorgensen, and I said, so I think I want to take my classical voice. And he just looked at me like, okay. So we kind of switched focus. I was doing a kind of a religion theater music combination thing at
Wow.
Gustavus.
The beauty of small schools that you can do that
right.
kind of thing, right?
So then we shift gears to kind of taking in my kind of traditional classical voice more seriously. And I auditioned for some grad schools that I thought I would like. And I didn't really anything happen right out of my first year out of Gustavus. But so I had a year in between there where I ended up doing a lot of musical theater. And ended up doing a show called The Original Broadway Swing, which I was subbing the person they had gotten. I don't remember if they got fired or if they were sick, but I ended up having to learn that whole show in like 4 or 5 days.
Oh
And it was like
no.
40, it's a review, so it's like 40 songs.
Oh no. Could you have
Yeah.
words on stage? No, I bet you couldn't.
No, no, no.
No.
Yeah. And there was added drama of an ex being in the chorus. And so
Oh
it was, yeah. Yeah. But right while I was doing that, I was also auditioning for grad school. So I'm like going from singing swing to singing Mozart arias. And I was like, you can't swing Mozart. You have to sing it straight tone. All of this is to say that I ended up in the University of Northern Colorado for my master's degree in voice and working with Dr. Melissa Maldi. And she worked a lot with kind of the Alexander technique and about muscle relaxation. I have a lot of tension as a singer in my throat and my neck because I was a bass trying to sing music theater, right? And so
Yeah.
I was pushing so much that I
Reaching.
had built up all this tension and reaching. And so I was trying to find a teacher that would help me with that. And Dr. Maldi was an instrumental part of helping me figure out how to use my voice the way I
Nice.
use it now and in a healthy way.
Yeah.
And two things I would say about that for people who are listening and people who think they might want to, you know, college kids or high school kids. Number one, the best piece of advice I got about picking out a grad school was the grad school is there to serve you. You're not there to serve the grad school. So if the grad school wants to exploit you, you know, being a GA, being an inquirer, being, you know, doing all the things, that's not the place for you to hone your craft, right?
Right.
You need to find a teacher that you understand what they are saying to you and that they understand what your instrument is. And always pick that teacher experience over any kind of prestige, over any kind of, you know, program, scholarship money, etc., because that the learning experience that you're going to do with that teacher is the whole point.
Got it.
Right. Dr. Maldi worked with me. Actually, I'm featured in her book. She wrote a book called What Every Singer Needs to Know About Their Body and More. And I'm a case study
Oh, cool.
in that book. And then also they were hiring a new opera director, Brian Clave Ludloff, who was openly gay. And as much as we kind of consider the performing arts to be a safe zone for people of the LGBT community, that isn't always the case,
Yeah,
in
that.
the opera world. The opera world is a very traditional place. One of the research projects I was working on in my grad program currently, I'm in a second grad program right now, working on my MFA in directing theater. But one of the things that I'm interested in is dealing with the voice and casting. So when we're, you know, we talk about transgender singers or you know, non-binary singers, and as they go through the process of their change, you know, their voice is fluctuating. So then
Right.
their voice type no longer identifies with or matches up traditionally with their visual appearance, right?
Right.
And so how do we in the performing world, in the casting world, in the directing world, think about that, and how do we change that, and what can we change and what can't we change, and how do we redefine, you know, all of what we call gender normativity in the performing arts.
Great.
So
Well,
this is
and
a
I
big fascinating subject for me.
that is fascinating. It's really fascinating, and I bet you there's not a lot of people looking at that.
One of the topics I was writing on in my grad program right now is, so often theater and opera and musical, any kind of performance, deals with race in a dichotomy where it's us versus them. And it doesn't, there's not a lot of material in which it treats identity as a community, as race as a community, and that there are multi, you know, there are multi facets to that, to the interplay of different culture. And so often our art and our theater really and our music t deals with it in as this one or the other thing. And
Well,
I think that's one of the things that music really has the advantage over other forms of art, is that it
yes.
allows for this integration of style. I mean, our American musical experience does this, right? You
Right,
know,
it's a
the integration of the
smorgasbord or
blues
a,
and yeah. And I think that this is why I love music, right? Going back to my original statement, it was never a genre thing. It was like, oh, it's just a different way of expressing yourself, right? And
Exactly. That's exactly what came into my mind. We came all the way around. And that's a good place to transition into the next part of this interview. I would love to talk. We could talk for hours on all this stuff,
yep,
definitely.
we could. Yes.
And right now, I want to move on to musical theater. And I know that you teach theater and music. And
Yep.
then you also musical direct shows and you act in shows and all those kinds of things. And I'm fascinated by musical theater. When I hear a musical theater song, I know it's musical theater. And so I'm curious to ask an expert of why. What is it about musical theater music? And I love it, that makes it a little different.
The place to start this conversation is asking yourself, why is there a song in this play? What is the point of
Got it.
us bursting into song? It has to do with the idea that we can no longer express ourselves with just the dialogue, right?
Cool.
That we need to heighten the emotion of the situation, and we do that by bursting into song, right?
Oh, I love that. I love
and
that.
So if you come from it at that place, what exactly does that mean? Well, you know, first off, you have to remember that you're acting, like you're telling a story through the way that you're using your voice and your body language. And that's a different approach, I think, than perhaps, you know, like an opera singer is more focused on the vocal production, right? And it's through compose, and it's more about the musical style. So while it's, yes, it's theater, yes, it's acting, yes, it's expression, it's coming from a place of executing the music, you know, accurately.
As opposed to telling the story so much.
As opposed to telling the story through your using your acting technique. And when I was studying with Ben Krywaz up at Nautilus Music Company and the Wesley Balk Opera Institute, he has this great term called ubu. He calls it oops and ubu. And oops is a mistake, right? But ubu is something that you're doing imperfectly on purpose.
Ah.
And
awesome.
And musical theater does that. It allows your inflection, your enunciation, your dynamic, you know, all of those things. Perhaps you're not singing the rhythm exactly the way it is on the page, but you're doing that in order to draw emphasis to a particular word, or, you know, sometimes you might shout a word or speak a word, or sometimes you might sing it more lyrically. People have made careers off of their ability to do that. I mean,
right.
Think of all the great divas that you know, right? Patti LuPone, Ethel Merman, you know, Bernadette Peters, my personal icon.
Yeah, oh, she's awesome. She is incredible.
Yeah. You know, all those theater singers, when you think about their voice, they are not singing in a kind of, you know, a traditional classical sense. They're also not singing in a full kind of traditional recording studio pop sense, right? It's
right.
still full out voice, but it's kind of broken up in a way, right?
Okay.
So that kind of style of approach to the acting, I think, is one of the things. The other thing, I was reading a really interesting book. It's called, a while ago, it's called The Sound of Broadway Music. And one of the things that they discuss in that book is how you can still tell it's a Broadway song even when there's no singer. Like if you just listen to the accompaniment.
Okay.
When we had talked about what we might discuss in this interview, I was thinking about, okay, how do I explain this? And orchestration is the deal. Okay. So orchestration is deciding how a song is going to be executed in the theater. So often the composer will write the song. A dance and arranger and a vocal arranger will kind of lay out all the harmonies and things like that. But the orchestrator is going to come in and decide what instruments are playing what part and all of those, you know, those kinds of things. And if you think about it like fashion, when you see something, somebody dressed and you go, oh, that person's still living in the 90s, or that person has got, you know, oh, that's a very 70s kind of thing. There are distinct like colors, shapes, stylistic things, right?
Yeah.
That you associate in your brain with, you know, a certain time period. So orchestrations are basically doing that. What instruments are we picking to help tell this, going back to the storytelling, to help tell the story? Am I using a bass clarinet and that clarinet is helping me think about, you know, the big band era? Am I using an electronic, you know, kind of drum beat mix, and that helps me think about the 80s. So these choices of instrumentation, these choices of color and texture are related to the storytelling, the time period, the,
you know,
the mood and things like that. All of that is informing what the lyrics are telling you, right?
Right.
As opposed to rock bands are great. Okay. You know, and if you listen to the Beatles, you got that four part Beatles sound, right? You know,
yeah.
It's the Beatles based on the instrumentation. You know, it's a rock band based on the way those instruments are functioning, the rhythm guitar, the lead guitar, the bass, the drum. So even like when Green Day did their musical of American Idiot, and they put that on stage, even though it's a rock-based musical, certain affectations to the orchestration is going to make it sound like theater music, even though it's a rock song. You know, think about
wow.
the way you, when you first experienced Rent, right? It's very intensely a rock show, but it's still using theatricality in terms of its percussion placement and its voice, you know, the voice forward and the mixing. It's not, you know,
yeah.
the voice is often a part of the texture in singing, but in theater, it's pushed out in front so that you're following the plot and the story.
Wow, that was a great tutorial, and I really appreciate it. And I think it's fascinating, and how, I mean, how you can have only so many notes and only so many instruments out there, and the plethora of styles and sounds that you can get from that, and how you can manipulate all that via what you were just talking about to make certain sounds and certain emotions, and all that is why I love music. I, you know, it's just glorious.
Yeah.
It's just glorious.
And I think the orchestrator job is often overlooked. I mean, we think about, you know, the great musical theater composers, Steve Sondheim, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein, and all of those people were specifically working with one specific orchestrator. If you think about all the Broadway shows that you can, you know, eras, hundreds, right? If you think of a smaller group of about 200 composer teams, right, there's even a smaller group of about 40 orchestrators. And those 40 orchestrators were teaching the next generation of how to orchestrate. So part of the thing that we hear as the Broadway sound is just because there were such a few people that were doing it, that
Hal
had their kind of fingerprints on
right.
what they were doing.
I did not know orchestrators existed. So to that point,
yeah.
that is very fascinating. So usually we have the quote section here, but we've had so much stuff to talk about here that we've kind of run out of time, but I'm going to say it, and we'll touch on it very briefly, but this is a Jerry Herman quote who wrote La Cage aux Folles, which is a show that you musical directing for the Merlin Players down at Paradis Center for the Performing Arts here. We're going to give you more details on that in a second. But this quote by Jerry Herman is, I have a lot of friends who get up most mornings and go to jobs they absolutely hate. I don't think that's what life is about. And I'm so fortunate that I actually love what I do. And the reason I love this quote is because it's obvious on the surface of what he's saying. But when you look at it a little deeper of how do you make that choice to do what you love as opposed to making money? And often that choice is made when you're talking about somebody going into the arts, and you're somebody
yes.
who did that. You made that choice.
Yeah.
And you knew that even if you went into performing or teaching, that's not something that you're going to ever bring home the big bucks, unless you are that 1% or whatever portion of a percent that makes it really big and actually has a lot of money. You know, and so how do you make that decision? I mean, how did you?
Well, when I was in grad school, I was doing the Met Opera circuit auditions, you know, and I was trying all the programs, and I was, you know, gonna make an opportunity for myself, right? I was trying everything I could.
Yeah.
I was flying all over. It was very stressful. As much as I love to sing, I have gotten to the point where it stresses me out, because I want to be able to do it my best every time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often an unrealistic expectation for yourself.
Yeah.
Especially when you're performing 8 shows a week, or you're doing it, you know, like if you're working in the live theater, there's just so many other factors, right?
Well, and also, you can never get it perfect. It's the nature of the beast. I mean,
yeah.
you can always
and
do it better.
That's part of the...
Right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. that's great. Harvey Fierstein, who wrote the book for La Cage, his title of his new memoir is called I Was Better Last Night. I just love
exactly.
that title. Yes, that's it, girl.
Exactly.
So when I was in grad school, my mom got cancer, and so I was wanting to move back to Minnesota, and this teaching opportunity kind of came to me out of the blue, and it all just, so it was like literally I didn't know what was next. My lease was up in my apartment and it just kind of fell into my lap. Nice. And I was able to come back here. And my voice teacher, I said to her, you know, am I giving up my career to go teach? And she said, those university jobs are hard to get. I would take it in a second. And I said, okay. And so I moved back here and I took this teaching job, and I've been here for 15 years. And I tried to keep going in terms of the, you know, auditions and making it happen. It's just this community is so remote. It's about, you know, we're about 3 hours from Minneapolis. And so I've made some inroads with the Sioux Falls Performing Arts community. That's about an hour away. I do miss it. And every time I do it, I always go, oh yeah, I like this.
Right.
You know? And so like right now we're doing Le Cage au Faux, and this is a bucket list role for me. It's number 2 on my bucket list.
Wow.
And so, yeah, kind of tying it back to your question, you have to love it to do it, and you will put up with a lot to do what you love if you really want to do it. But there are ways, and I think that I have found a pretty good balance of being able to do both in terms of, you know, have a job and a career as a teacher and still be able to direct and teach students. And then having the time, you know, in the summer to go do performing gigs. It's a sacrifice for sure. I mean, my other half is always like, you're never home. You know, it's hard. Dating a musician is hard. And every musician that I know has this struggle where musicians work when everyone else is relaxing, right? Musicians work at night, so you're going to be entertained on the weekend. Musicians work on a holiday, so you have somewhere to take your fam. Like, and so I think that's an aspect you have to consider. You're going to miss a lot of things because you're the destination.
Right. Exactly. Right. And I think it's easier to be in a relationship with somebody who's in the performing arts or, you know, that perform than not, because just for that reason of you're working at the same time, perhaps, or if the other person isn't working, at least they understand it. Your worst gig. I have to hear about that.
Okay.
And a best gig too, at a best gig.
Although I have some really favorite gigs, I think probably the most exhilarating was my first time being a professional, like making a professional opera debut and, you know, singing with people from the Met and Houston Grand Opera and like people who were like big hitters. And I'm like the peon who knew nothing and just held on for my dear life. You know, I think this is a thing that people underestimate, how much better other people who are better than you make you, right? Because you're riding the tidal wave of what they are doing, and you just learn so much
from
that experience. Some of my favorite things that I've done are shows that I've directed where I just feel like there was just the synthesis of meaning and performance in the audience, and it just really spoke to the moment. I'm specifically thinking about when we did South Pacific here at the high school in Worthington. It was right during the DACA demonstrations, and the kids were walking out of school and they were going to get suspended for leaving the school. And we had a show, but we were doing the show South Pacific, which is about race essentially, if you're that show. And the kids were all worried. And I said, if you're going out on that street because you're supporting your friends, then who cares about what we're doing in the theater?
Right.
That's important. And it's also the same thing, that the message that we're giving in this show.
Nice. Right?
If you're going out there to screw around because it's cool, then I'm going to be crappy. But they all were able to come and do the show. And, you know, when we got to that moment in the second act where he sings, you've got to be carefully taught, you know, and it's just this culmination of all of our work, and the kids were all like right there, and they're like, oh, we get it. This is more than music. This is more than theater. This is more than extracurricular. This is meaning. that is alive and speaking to our community. And that to me was like one of the best moments of my career thus
I
far.
Bet. Maybe even more important there, right? With the kids that are going out into the world here, they're learning this stuff.
I'm a big believer that you can't change the things that were in front of you. You can only change the things that are behind you, right? And affecting those kids and helping them see the world in a new way, in a new light is a big moment for me.
Yeah,
you know,
that's beautiful.
That's important.
Yeah.
But my worst gig, I'll tell you.
Let's hear it.
I was the body double for the Beast in Beauty and the Beast. So in the professional production, when the Beast transforms back into the prince at the end of the show, from about the sequence from the fight with Gaston in the castle to when Belle like kisses the Beast or cries, I forget what the affect is, but you know, before the love happens, right?
Right, right.
That sequence, they use a body double so that the performer has the time to switch back into the prince, right?
Yeah.
In the professional production, they raise you, they suspend you in the air and spin you, and then the other character comes down, right? The other actor as the prince, the real Beast, right, comes down, and then the body double disappears.
There's got to be some smoke involved.
There's flashing lights, smoke.
Right.
There's Disney orchestrations and money.
Right.
So I'm going up in the air, and the line, something happened with the ZFX that it drops me. And I land on my shoulder 16 feet onto the stage floor.
Oh, no.
And my shoulder just goes, boom.
Did you say this was during a performance?
Yep, matinee day, of course.
Oh no.
That was a challenging. I've had lots of incidents with my shoulder in the opera. You know, I had an incident with the turntable in Les Mis with Joubert too during the fight. And the turntable in my arm went one way and my body stayed on the stage floor. So
it's more physical issues for you than performance related, which is, I guess, is a good thing, except that you're getting injured.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's wrap up with talking about La Cage aux Folles, your musical director, and you're in it.
Yes, I'm playing Alban Zaza, the main star performer.
Yep. Awesome.
And this is a kind of a fun thing. So my friend Michael is playing George, the husband, and we, the two of us did a year with Frog and Toad with Merlin Players, I don't know, a long time ago. And while we were doing that, we said, oh, wouldn't it be fun to play George and Alban? Because it's basically the same relationship as Frog and Toad. And, you know, we're both openly gay. We both have long, you know, term partners. And I've known him for Michael for over 20 years. And so Juliana Skazacek, the director and artistic director of Merlin Players, she was like, well, what's left on your bucket list? I said, there are two things, La Cage aux Folles and Sweeney Todd. So we called Michael, and Michael's like, hey, do we want to do La Cage, Michael? He's like, okay, yeah. So yeah, back in, was it 2020, we were supposed to do it, and then it got shut down. And so this La Cage is a big important role for me in terms of not only the theatrics and the singing, but also just personally as, you know, an openly gay performer and coming back. I grew up in Medford, as I said, and, you know, coming back to the Faribault Community Theater, that's where I learned. I mean, I was in there at a very young age. And so this is kind of a big homecoming. And Michael's also from Faribault. He lives in St. Paul now. So it's, you know, he likes to say, the boys are back in town.
Nice. The boys are back in town and we can all go see them. We can all see you in this show. And the show is June 17th, 18th. 23rd, 24th, 25th at 7:30 p.m. And then on Sundays, the 19th and the 26th at 2:00 p.m. And you can get tickets where?
ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org website. And you can also call them, but I think it's best to get online.
All right. If you're on Facebook and if you're a friend of mine, or go to my page and there's a link in my promo for this show that will take you there as well. So we've done a lot of talking about this show and that you're coming out and that you're openly gay. And so it's an important character for you. So maybe we should just do a short synopsis of the show and why it speaks to you.
So Le Cage aux Folles is based on a play called Le Cage aux Folles by Jean Piret. I forget. If you're familiar with the movie The Birdcage with yes. Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. So the movie Birdcage is based on the same play as Le Cage aux Folles is based. So they both have the same source material. So basically the setup is that Georges owns this club. It's a kind of vaudeville, you know, burlesque kind of drag performing club on the French Riviera, and his partner Zaza. Well, his partner is named Alban. His drag name is Zaza, is the star of this review. And George has a child from a previous relationship with a female, and this child is wanting to get married. So they bring he's bringing his fiance to meet the parents, right?
Yes, and great setup.
He's embarrassed. Yeah, he's embarrassed by Zaza and all of that. So he tries to hide Zaza, but then in the musical, the mom doesn't show up, and so Zaza becomes Mama. The fiance, this girlfriend's parents are conservative politicians. He's a politician. Yikes.
It's just the setup is getting better and better for mayhem and misunderstandings.
Yes. Yes. You know, mayhem and resolution.
Right. And things are learned. And it's so wonderful with comedy when you learn these important lessons. And but it doesn't hit you over the head with it. It does it with joy.
And it does it with love.
And it does it with that, joy and love.
You know,
yes.
the love story between Georges and how it sustains. What we know, what we learned it has sustained, and what it is being asked to do. And, you know, the son, Jean-Michel, he sees that. There's this beautiful moment at the end of the show where right at that moment, Jean-Michel realizes that nothing else matters except the fact that he has these parents who are willing to do anything for him. And it's my favorite moment because I make eye contact the actor's name is Nick, and he sings a song, and I get teary eyed every time because it's this moment of acceptance and this moment of acknowledgement that you hurt somebody and now you get it, you know,
right.
And it's just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful moment.
And and for all of us to strive toward getting it for everybody that's out there, no matter their color or their ethnicity or their sexuality or their gender or anybody that you consider other, if we could get people to a place of getting it, how beautiful would that
yes.
be? And I think theater and music goes a long way toward helping that. And so
absolutely.
Let's just end it there.
Absolutely.
We'll end it there except to say happy Pride Month. And this is a great show to have on this month. And we will see you at the theater. Thanks so much, Eric. Take care.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Eric for the joyous and oh, so interesting conversation today. What a blessing it is for me to get to talk about musical theater. Woohoo! Thanks also and always to Wendy Norquist and to you for listening to Musician Talk on the One, KYMN. You have a terrific day.